John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Well, call it a lame duck if you want, but the Senate is taking a big vote tomorrow. Democrats are going ahead with a vote on the Keystone XL pipeline. Republican Senator John Hoeven from North Dakota is the pipeline's top sponsor in the Senate, and he joins us in a few minutes. And that pipeline ends in Louisiana, and we're also going to ask whether that vote could be enough to save incumbent Senator Mary Landrieu in her runoff fight to stay in the Senate. Plus, we look at the history of our capital before it became today's gleaming home to dysfunctional politics, more on how D.C. went from swamp to the marble-clad metropolis it is today. My hometown has a mixed reputation for sure, but we want to hear some stories about your hometown. From Belmar, New Jersey, we got this. I grew up where the Susquehanna and Chenango Rivers come together. Binghamton was an industrial town whose fortunes rose and fell like the rivers. Prosperous in the 50s, the plants shut down in the 70s and 80s. Now it's just trickling along, sometimes half empty, sometimes half full. But we begin with the death of another American at the hands of the Islamic State. This time, U.S. aid worker Peter Kasich. Kasich's brutal beheading was circulated in a video released by ISIS this weekend. His family has requested that the public remember Peter for his work in Syria, and we wanted to take a moment to do that now. In a statement on Sunday, Kasich's family said, "We prefer our son is written about and remembered for his important work and the love he shared with family and friends, not in the manner the hostage takers would use to manipulate Americans and further their cause." Michael Downey is a freelance journalist and photographer currently based in Beirut and a former friend and colleague of Kasich's. And he says Peter's smile and willingness to help made him an unforgettable figure amidst the chaos of war.
He was actually one of the first people I met when I came to Beirut. And he was crashing on my roommate and I's couch, Josh Wood. And he stayed there for almost a month while he was looking for another apartment. And, you know, it's a really tight-knit community here. Journalists, aid workers, and, you know, everyone kind of watches each other's backs. And, you know, it's like a family. And he really was key in introducing me to this family of people, you know, the same group that's been the past month been working tirelessly to try and appeal for his release and, you know, contacting everyone and anyone. Brilliant guy. I remember the first time I saw him, you know, it's just he always had this infectious big smile, and he called everyone, you know, he called everyone brother. Yeah, like it didn't matter if, you know, he didn't know you, he could always see good in people, and just really, really positive guy.
Now, by the time you knew Peter Kasich, of course, he was already a veteran of the Iraq War. I guess he joined up in 2004, and he was working on his aid organization in Syria. Tell us a little bit about that transition for him, as far as you knew, from being a warfighter and a soldier to someone really trying to help.
You know, I don't know much exactly about the, you know, his time in the military there. It was something he didn't necessarily talk about a lot. But you know, it was very clear that he had witnessed firsthand that the damage that war does, and especially the deep scars that it brought on the region here. And, you know, there was a quote from him saying, you know, I could be another young man with a gun, or I can actually help people. And he realized that the only way things are going to get better is to really reject any violence or war and help individual people. Because, I mean, obviously, he'd see not only in Iraq, but of course the horrific conditions in Syria that people were stuck in.
Still, Michael Downey, a lot of people feel just the same way that Peter Kasich did, but they don't necessarily take it upon themselves to go deep into a war zone to help people directly. It sounds like he was really driven.
Yeah, he was a remarkable individual. A lot of people would have been deterred going there, you know, but he knew he was best suited with his training and everything and his medic experience that he would be best suited in an ambulance, first responder, stabilizing people, getting to the hospital, bringing medical supplies. He knew, you know, exactly the bare bones, what was needed to run a medical clinic and, you know, what would make the difference between saving someone's life. And he knew the risks in these areas, but he also knew that where he was needed most, he had to be there.
Michael, how would you or maybe your friends interpret Peter Kasich's conversion to Islam? That happened while he was in captivity. Was he religious?
You know, I can't say much about that just because no one knows the exact circumstances of it. But, you know, he had a deep connection with the land, the culture, and the people here. I remember he observed Ramadan with the Syrians in Tripoli, and, you know, just out of solidarity. But it's hard to say.
Were you in touch with Peter's family during the time that all of you were trying to coordinate for his release?
That was run on point by Elliot Stemp. He was working with Pete in Gaziantep in Turkey for his aid organization, SARA, and then has also been integral in trying to get information, see, you know, just any kind of negotiation. And he's been on point with the family because obviously, the family has been, you know, there's a lot of people reaching out to them and we've been, you know, trying to respect their privacy. And then, you know, each person has their role in this.
Well, Michael Downey, before we let you go, what would you like the world to remember about your friend Peter Kasich?
You know, I'd like them to remember that, the young man who never gave up, and he tried to always do his best and just be kind to people. You know, it's too easy to perpetuate hate, and it's harder to do the right thing, but he would do that. He would stick to his principles. And also, you know, more importantly, you know, why he went there, because there are many people still stuck in this brutal conflict with no way out. And, you know, he went there to help them. So, you know, to not forget all those people who have died or are suffering and are still in this.
Michael Downey, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Downey is a freelance journalist and photographer based in Beirut, and a former friend and colleague of Abdulrahman Peter Kasich. In a departure from previously released execution footage, the film depicting Peter Kasich's death also included a history of the Islamic State since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, as well as footage of the mass execution of Syrian servicemen. And perhaps it's no coincidence that the latest video surfaced just hours after Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey said that the battle against ISIS was starting to turn in favor of the U.S. and its allied forces in Iraq and Syria. Joining me from Baghdad in Iraq is the BBC's Hugh Sykes. Hi, Hugh.
Hello, Todd.
Good to have you. Hugh, Martin Dempsey told U.S. troops over the weekend, as I said, that ISIS had pretty much peaked. Does anyone in Baghdad have that sense?
No. I think it's more hope, inshallah, than an actual belief that they've peaked. One thing they seem to be doing more and more is giving the impression that they're retreating from certain areas, and the Iraqi armed forces go in and then ISIS come back and surround them. Classic military trap. A lot of people here are talking about something else that General Martin Dempsey said while he was here in Iraq over the weekend. He described IS rather hazardously, in my view, as, and I quote, a bunch of midgets running around with a radical ideology, and he described them as not a 10-foot-tall force. And then within 24 hours almost of him saying that, almost certainly coincidentally, but a bit of a hostage to fortune, within a day of him saying that, we hear about Peter Kasich and the 14 presumed Syrian Air Force and Army officers being the victims of mass murder by IS. So slightly odd statement to describe a very nasty, ruthless, psychopathic, mass-murdering enemy as a bunch of midgets when they're clearly not.
And that was a surprising comment coming from the Joint Chiefs Chairman. Do you think that was just motivational boasting for troops? I mean, the president himself already has said he shouldn't have called ISIS a junior varsity terrorist squad.
Well, yes, exactly. And I'm sure that was meant for the audience, but I don't believe the general is so naive as to believe that what he says to a large audience of American military people here in Iraq is not going to leak out into the general public. The whole issue of Islamic State is, of course, dominating people's minds here in Iraq. In Baghdad, most people think that the city is safe from any kind of invasion or approach by ISIS. But they did get into a town south of Baghdad two or three weeks ago, very near one of the holy Shia shrine cities, Karbala, and they're only driven out of that town with the help of Iranian-backed militias. And another effect of ISIS's advance has been a flood of refugees from some of the areas which have been taken over by ISIS, particularly Tal Afar and Mosul right up in the north, and Tikrit and Samarra further down to the south, and they're even in a town just 60 kilometres, about 40 miles north of Baghdad. So it's in the background all the time with almost everybody that you speak to here. And I, in fact, went to a refugee camp here in Baghdad this morning, a place of astonishing squalor and disorganization. It's a school where the school classes still continue, but refugees from the far north of Iraq are also living in some of the classrooms. There's barely any sanitation, and there's nowhere to throw any rubbish, and there's no rubbish collection, and the place is a squalid mess. And it's as a result of ISIS advances into parts of Iraq.
And Hugh Sykes, I mean, it's one thing for residents of Baghdad to feel like their country is safe. It's another thing, or their city is safe, I should say. It's quite another thing for them to feel like their government, their country is safe. And another thing still for them to be experiencing the return of what's nearly 3,000 U.S. troops now.
Well, yes. Not quite yet at the moment, but certainly the 1,200 here at the moment and 1,500 have been promised by Washington, although there could be obstruction from Congress, who knows. Back to General Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He also said in Washington last week to the House Armed Services Committee that he was seriously considering, not necessarily recommending, but seriously considering, his words, the return of a modest number of combat troops
Indeed.
To Baghdad. And revealingly, I spoke to the leader of one of those awakening movements who, if you remember, were crucial in joining up with the Americans 5 or 6 years ago and driving al-Qaeda in Iraq, mostly out of Iraq, that joint operation between the Awakening and the United States. Here was this Awakening member now, whose new enemy is ISIL, the Islamic State, telling me twice that he wants American combat troops, to come back to Iraq because he believes that is the only way for ISIS, Islamic State, to be defeated. American combat troops alongside Iraqi armed forces, not just these train and assist people.
Advisors, and there are plenty of critics right here in the United States who think the same thing, and that the White House's strategy ultimately will require those types of ground troops. Hugh Sykes of the BBC in Baghdad, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be with the Takeaway again.
Good to have you. Well, on the eve of one of the most anticipated votes in the Senate this year, we have a conversation coming up with one of the most important and influential voices in the debate over the Keystone XL pipeline in the Senate. He's Republican Senator from North Dakota, John Hoeven, and he's feeling pretty upbeat.
The key now is whether there are 60 votes in the Senate, which means we'd have to have 15 Democrats, and we'll find out the answer to that on Tuesday.
The Keystone XL pipeline up for a big vote in the Senate. Will Democrats deliver for John Hoeven? Will they deliver for Senator Mary Landrieu, who's trying to survive in Louisiana? That's all coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For just about 6 years, Congress and the White House have been debating the Keystone XL oil pipeline. Parts of that pipeline are already built, but the final vision has oil running from Canada's tar sands, traveling south through the Midwest to the U.S. Gulf Coast. Well, taking his cue from environmental groups, President Obama so far has balked at the pipeline, saying it won't do much for U.S. jobs, but will put an enormous toll on the Earth's carbon load.
We're going to let the process play itself out. And one major determinant of whether we should approve a pipeline shipping Canadian oil to world markets, not to the United States, is does it contribute to the greenhouse gases that are causing climate change.
Meanwhile, proponents, and there are some Democrats in that group, see the pipeline as a job creator and another way to get the U.S. off of Mideast oil. Well, after losing the midterms, Senate Democrats are now ready to vote on Keystone. That vote is expected tomorrow, and they're also hoping it could save the dimming prospects of Democratic oil patch Senator Mary Landrieu, who's trying to survive a big runoff election next month in Louisiana, where the Keystone XL pipeline would end. Our next guest is the main sponsor of the Keystone Pipeline in the Senate, Republican North Dakota Senator John Hoeven. And he says that the Keystone Pipeline is necessary for U.S. energy security and that he's now within just a vote or two of those 60 votes he'll need to get Keystone to pass.
You've got to look at the bigger picture. Here's the reality. For us to have the kind of energy plan for this country that we want, where we're truly energy secure, meaning we produce energy from all different sources, and working with our closest friend and ally, Canada, we produce more than the amount of oil we consume, so we don't need to get it from the Middle East. And in order to do those things, which is absolutely possible and we're on our way, we need the infrastructure to move that product around the country, and that means adequate pipelines and rail and trucking, roads. But we've got to have that infrastructure in the right mix in order to move energy safely and efficiently. And so the Keystone XL pipeline is an example of the kind of infrastructure we need to truly build the right energy plan for our country.
One of the arguments, as you know, Senator Hoeven, is that this oil from the tar sands in Canada, most of it doesn't stay for the domestic market, doesn't contribute to energy independence. It goes from Canada through the pipeline, ostensibly over our land, to our refinery, sure, but then just onto the world market.
Well, in actuality, if you look at the Department of Energy's report, you'll see that we do need more oil and that this oil will be utilized in the United States. And in addition, that we intend to put 100,000 barrels a day, for starters, into the pipeline from the oil fields in North Dakota and Montana, which is domestically produced light sweet Bakken crude. So that's not, your point is not correct. Some may be exported. Some will be used here instead of us using oil from the Middle East.
Now, there's still one major thing, of course, that stands between you and victory here. Well, two things. You mentioned you're close to that 60 votes. We'll see if you get that 60 votes. That may happen. If not, you'll get it in January, I'm sure. The president has still said that he's leaning against this. At least its spokesman said the White House takes a dim view of this vote, and you may get a veto here.
I think he will veto it. All along, I've thought, as I said, our pathway would be that to get to 60 votes, I'd need to bring my bill forward in the new Congress. Again, as you said, due to circumstances that relate to the race in Louisiana, now the bill's been brought up. We'll see if we get 60 in the Senate. We may. I think we may get 60 votes. We're very close. We'll see.
And
if we don't, though, we'll pass it after the first year. So we'll pass the bill.
Yeah.
I think you're right, though. I think the president will veto it. I mean, if you look at his comments earlier, and you don't, he's held this project up for 6 years. You don't hold up a project for 6 years if you support it. So obviously he's tried to defeat it with endless delays. So I think he will veto it. But all along, I've anticipated that he likely would do that. So then what we'll have to do is bring it back and either include it in broader energy legislation or maybe attach it to an appropriations bill. And I think ultimately we'll be able to do one of those things and get the bill passed if we are not able to override his veto directly.
Now, Senator John Hoeven of North Dakota, how far do you think Republicans should go in the new year? You said attach it to an appropriations bill, and you and I both work in Washington, and these days, attaching anything to an appropriations bill causes all of us in the media to wonder if you're not courting a government shutdown. We've had fights over issues like this in the past. Immigration will be roiling, and everybody always asks if controversial items are in appropriations measures. Does that mean the possibility of a shutdown over this issue?
No, because we'll go back to regular order as the Senate has traditionally had, and that was one of the things that Senator Reid changed. We'll go back to regular order. I'm a member of the Appropriations Committee, and that means we'll pass our appropriations bills in the committee, and then we'll bring those appropriations bills individually to the floor, and there's 12 of them. And so instead of ending up in the situation that we have been, where we're working on either a continuing resolution or an omnibus, kind of an all-or-nothing bill to keep the government funded,
yep.
We'll go through the proper regular order, pass those bills individually. Now, if there's something in one of those individual bills that we fight over with the president, that doesn't shut down the government.
Right. Only if there's a big omnibus or a shutdown scenario. You know, I'm going to let you go, Senator Hovind, but, you know, it's Louisiana's not settled, but, you know, unfortunately, we're all looking at 2016 already, and so is the president. You know, President Obama is getting pretty close to lame duck territory here. I wonder if you don't think before in the new year, if you pass this again, before he vetoes it again, whether he consults with Senator Clinton, with Secretary Hillary Clinton again, about where she wants this thing to be if she's a nominee.
Well, I actually started working on this when I was governor before I came to the Senate in 2011. At that time, it was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and I believe she was ready to approve the project. Now, again, she'll speak for herself, and we'll see. But I really do think that we have a very good chance to get this project next year, based on kind of the scenario I just ran through with you.
Years of wrangling, years of debate, an election, and still a runoff in Louisiana to go. Senator John Hovind is Republican from North Dakota, has been probably the main proponent of the Keystone XL pipeline for all of those 6 years, on the cusp of getting it passed, or so it seems. Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to the sound that a comet makes. That mysterious clicking comes from Comet 67P out there in the middle of the solar system with the Philae probe riding right on top. And it's been about 5 days since the Rosetta's Philae lander successfully touched down on Comet 67P. And after 57 hours of gathering data, Philae powered down for a long nap, its batteries dying early on Saturday morning. Well, among the last bits of data that Philae sent were the readings from an instrument called COSAC, which included an additional photograph and results from a drilling attempt in the comet's surface. Joining me now is Eric Hand, staff reporter for Science Magazine, where he covers Earth and planetary science. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
That sound is just great, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. What a ride.
And can you get over it? The first time I heard it, I thought, frogs in the river? Like, what is that? It's a comet.
Yeah, no, these are strange beasts of the solar system, always changing, spewing off gas and dust. They're unknown worlds.
Well, what have we learned so far? Let's get down to the facts. 57 hours of gathering data. Now Philae is dealing with a dead battery. So what have we learned so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a while for the science teams to figure out what they have and don't have. They're still just trying to figure out how the landing even happened. I mean, this fantastic bounce, it didn't land just one time, but rather three times. It bounced up in the air a kilometer high and moved a kilometer to the side before finally coming to rest. I think it's going to be several weeks before they have any sense of the data that they have in hand.
Now, we have to remember that the comet, it just doesn't have a whole lot of gravity, hence the bounce. It's not like you get in contact and you stick to it. It bounced and they had to use the thrusters on Philae's head to sort of push it down into the surface.
Well, that's what they were hoping for. And these thrusters didn't actually work, and neither did the harpoons. And so that was that was the main reason for the bounce. I think they actually consider themselves quite lucky to have stuck in the end at all.
So the batteries on Philae have gone dead, and that's no surprise. They got about 57 hours out of a 60-hour battery, so that's not too bad. But it has solar panels. Can those panels bring it back to life, or is there enough sunlight? How does that work?
It's doubtful. One of the very last things they did before the battery died was to shift the position of the lander slightly and to angle the solar panels a bit more favorably. But they're only getting about an hour and a half of sunlight every day on these solar panels. And that's just not going to be enough to really boost it back into any sort of science gathering position. You know, I think the best they can hope for is occasional radio contact. And then, you know, they're hoping that maybe as the comet itself gets closer to the sun, the light conditions will change. And as the seasons change, that they might be able to gather a little bit more light. So, you know, it's too early to say that the mission is completely over. But the landing component, I think, more or less is. They're also quick to point out that the Rosetta orbiter is still in wonderful health and is going to be circling this comet at close range for another year and a half.
Mm. Now, there have been some comments suggesting that Philae may try to take off again, maybe use even those spindly legs to kind of hop off of the comet, which doesn't have a lot of gravity, as I said. I've heard maybe even return to Rosetta. That sounded a little bit far-fetched. Because there's not really a point, right? There's no redocking procedure. Rosetta's not coming back to Earth, right?
No. This is the final resting home for the Philae lander. It doesn't have enough energy to jump or hop, and no, there's no way it could get back up to the elevation of the orbiter.
So, Eric Hand, we're still in the process of gathering data. It's going to be a while before we know what we know. But as you're covering planetary and Earth sciences there at Science Magazine, what are the, you know, top one or two things that you want to know when they start putting out reports or data from the team here? What are the mysteries of the comet that you think are the most important?
I think the big question about comets is you know, so they're always described as pristine building blocks for the solar system. These objects were formed in the very first days of the solar system over 4.5 billion years ago, and they've been virtually unchanged since then. You know, they've been locked in a deep freeze. So if you can understand the composition of these comets, you then know something about the composition of the solar system itself. Another key part of that is many people think that comets were really important for delivering water to Earth. And by understanding the exact chemistry of the water in the ice of these comets, you can learn something about whether they were responsible for delivering that water to Earth or not.
And I wanted to ask you about that before we let you go, because there's a lot of suspicion that comets did deliver the water that make up our oceans. Kind of hard to wrap your head around that, but would we expect to find similar constituents in a comet as we have in the oceans? It's not going to be briny water.
No, I mean, their comet ice is H2O, just like on Earth. The key question is whether the water on Earth came from the Earth itself, whether it came from comets, or whether it came from asteroids, or some combination of all three. And, you know, I think Rosetta is going to help us understand what fraction of it came from comets. Another big question is, how did this comet form to begin with, this weird duck shape? I think they're going to have a really good chance at figuring out whether this thing came together as two different pieces or not.
Eric Hand, staff reporter for Science Magazine, covering Earth and planetary science, bringing us up to date on Rosetta and Philae riding on top of that giant cosmological dirty snowball that is 67P that has everyone fascinated. Eric, thank you.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Let's return to Washington now for a moment. Not the Washington of today, but the Washington of yesterday. And not so much to talk about politics, but to hear about the Capitol itself and the way it was. Today, Washington's mostly seen as an orderly layout of nice white marble government buildings. Sort of looks like Paris, if you look at it from above. Well, we've all heard the story on tours or in history class that George Washington chose French-American architect and Revolutionary War veteran Pierre L'Enfant to design the Capitol, and that L'Enfant laid out a visionary plan where important buildings were strategically placed by waterways, by the river, and broad boulevards, avenues running through the city. But from those plans to the reality, a lot was left out. J.D. Dickey is author of the new book, Empire of Mud, The Secret History of Washington, D.C., and it tells us why by the 1800s, L'Enfant called Washington a contemptible hamlet, and we're kind of calling it a dump.
The city as we know it today looks very different than it did in the 19th century, because for one thing, a lot of it simply didn't exist. If you wandered west of the Washington Monument, you were underwater. because all of that was filled in later. And so there was a lot of not only muck and humidity, of course, that added to the malarial aspect of the city. And it was definitely called a swamp, even though technically I don't think it's exactly a swamp, but it's very close to it. And of course, swamp comes with a rich range of metaphor as well.
Sure, I was going to say metaphorically, swamp is the only place your mind can really land, given the local industry.
Exactly.
But west of the Washington Monument, you're talking about what's now the World War II Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, those places that are famous.
That's right. And back then, a lot of that part of town, if you could call it that, was called the Potomac Flats. And it was known for various mosquitoes, among other things, and all kinds of infectious diseases. And also it was the outlet of the much feared and dreaded Washington City Canal, which is now Constitution Avenue. And the City Canal was originally devised to be a fine channel for commerce from one part of the city to another, but it ended up being an open sewer that ran right by the Capitol, through the middle of downtown, and with its outlet near the Potomac Flats.
An open sewer. Listen to you. More of your metaphors for Washington.
I know. They just come quick and ready.
Well, J.D. Dickey, you know, I'm really curious to have you take us on a little bit of a personal tour here. Let's imagine ourselves in the year 1815, let's say, maybe standing on Capitol Hill as it exists. It's a real hill. These days, Pennsylvania Avenue's a broad avenue with bike lanes and museums, traffic lights, embassies, all the way to the White House. Let's stroll down that area around 1815. What kinds of people, what kinds of things would we be seeing then?
Well, if we're going down Pennsylvania Avenue, we'd probably be on horseback or in a carriage because the street was unwalkable. It had huge furrows of mud during certain seasons and dust in others. Some people claim that it was unpassable, and it was really an unfortunate aspect of the city that this great thoroughfare was in such terrible condition. It wasn't even lit at night. It had no street lighting or sidewalks. And so that was your centerpiece between Capitol Hill and the White House. Now, along each side, what we're developing were some low-rent neighborhoods, some populations of reasonable homes and manors and things like that, but really those extremes of wealth and poverty I talked about. Already at that time developing were boarding houses where various politicians would stay, and a lot of these boarding houses developed into brothels. And brothel keeping ended up being one of the major illicit industries of Washington City at the time. And you had your gambling halls and open street gambling and things like that as well, along with matches of blood sport, bear baiting and cockfighting and that sort of thing. So it was really a chaotic, interesting, disturbing city and very much different than what we see today.
I really want to make sure we don't leave this conversation, J.D. Dickey, without talking about the role of slavery in the development of Washington City and Washington, D.C. People are more familiar in recent years with the role of slavery in building the Capitol itself, the Capitol building, but that's just one very small part of it.
That's true. Slaves helped to build the city, and they built the Capitol, and their labor may have been used on the White House and digging trenches for the Washington City Canal and all other aspects that you can think of that went into the creation of the early city. People called it the great man market of the nation, Washington, D.C., and that made it a bit different from other major cities of the time. And here you could find slave auctions operating openly and slave gangs being dragged through the street on chains. And in fact, at major hotels, slaves were chained to the walls of basements while their owners kept prim company in the upper floors. So the legacy of slavery is a deep and disturbing one, and it's one that is really hard to get away from when you plunge into the history of the city.
And forget about the swamp. That is the truly squalid part of the history of Washington, D.C. for sure. And then throughout history, you know, in the 1900s and well into the 20th century as well, you know, Washington, D.C. for a long time had a reputation as an extremely violent, extremely dangerous city. Now, that has abated a lot over the last 5 to 10 years. It's a much safer city than it used to be. But I get the sense that you have in the history that you've told sort of the seeds of the violence that plagued parts of the city for so long were sown long ago.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Washington, D.C. was an incredibly violent place, especially in its pre-Civil War and Civil War era and up through the Gilded Age as well. And it was so incredibly violent because one reason was because of the lack of police presence. You had a handful of constables that were expected to patrol beats that were miles long. And so crime routinely broke out and mob violence and all other aspects of bad behavior, bad and criminal, but as well as socially accepted violence broke out. And you could see that throughout the city in various different ways, even beyond just street crime. You could even have instances wherein a visiting politician like former Tennessee Governor Sam Houston in 1832 could come into the city, find one of his adversaries, and beat him with a cane until he was senseless. And for that crime, Houston ended up paying a fine of $500, which wasn't great at the time and today would be considered absurd.
That legacy endured, of course, into the 60s, the 1968 riots on U Street and other parts of Washington, D.C., into the 70s and 80s with turf battles and horrible drug problems in Washington. These days, though, deep economic problems still exist in Washington. There's no doubt about it. It is a city under transformation. There's just an enormous amount of investment. Is it changing Washington in a fundamental way from the 200 years that you write about, or is it just kind of a blip as you see it in the long arc?
I think the modern development of Washington, D.C. actually makes Pierre L'Enfant look pretty good because now his blueprint has come to fruition and the beautiful residences and the investment and the kinds of the original conception of gentrification that you would put the gentry somewhere has come to pass. But of course, this is only one aspect of the city. Coexisting with that is still that desperate poverty that we talked about in places like Anacostia and other neighborhoods. And that also follows from this early history, the way it was all laid out, not only laid out in the positive way by L'Enfant, but also the thrust of development that Boss Shepherd and other people did to create the city as we now know it.
J.D. Dickey is author of Empire of Mud, The Secret History of Washington.
Thank you.
Oh, today we also asked you about the defining moments of your hometown, and a listener in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts tells us the Bumpus family was one founding family in Wareham, Massachusetts. They eventually married the McCardles and then into the Berrio family. The town museum has a lot of history. Buildings that survived hurricanes are still in use, and the family's descendants still live in and around the area. That's great. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.